Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Have a go at these questions first. Is awareness the same as Buddha nature, the nature of the mind? Don't know. Buddha nature is not a word that it comes in later. It's from a later school. I don't know what it means really. But the danger there is you reify. I think I was looking for the word in my mind where you concretize something that isn't concrete. Awareness is not an object. The thing is, if you say awareness is Buddha nature, then you start to look for Buddha nature and you're done. You cannot find awareness, you can only be aware. So I've seen the word around a lot, obviously, but I've never really used it much. Probably every now and then, and I've thought, well, do I really know what I'm talking about? So, but consider that any kind of quantified experience, like even happiness or bliss or peace, as soon as we quantify it, we look for it, and we try to get it as an object. And the subtlety of this is that awareness is not an object. So to give up the kind of grasping of objects, the seeking of identity in objects is not so. It's kind of intuitive, I suppose, but it's not so. Again, it seems like it's nothing. It seems like it's nothing, but it's actually quite hard to do because we just find ourselves engaged with thoughts and ideas and plans and so on. In meditation, people can get very good at paying attention to objects. So you can do body sweeping and become very, very refined on, like, I remember meeting a man and his capacity to concentrate on, go through the body, and he described what he could do. Amazing, amazing what he could do. He had no wisdom. All he was doing was like a horse in a box, stuck on objects, on that which is conditioned. But the understanding of the unconditioned, he didn't get it. But you could sense that he wanted to get something else because he preferred much more to serve on a retreat rather than practice to do it. He was very good at this technique, very, very good. And it was quite interesting. And in the beginning, I felt kind of intimidated. Wow, I can't do that. But then I saw the result, actually, wasn't so good. Because the mind was attached to form rather than the formless. Attached to condition rather than understanding what the unconditioned is. So awareness is awareness. And rather than making something out of it, again, maybe like the language of trust and faith is helpful rather than trying to quantify, because you cannot quantify it, can you? You can quantify objects of awareness, like happiness or pain or things like that, right? Another non-answer. Buddha nature. But again, I'm not just kind of really, you find that word in later Buddhism. You don't really, I don't think you find it in Theravada. So here's a two-part question. I'll do the second part first. Is the knowing, which is our true home, also the consciousness which is considered unsatisfactory in the reading from this morning about the khandhas? In the word that's being referred to is vijnana, and vijnana khanda is unsatisfactory, but vijnana is used in two ways. There's vijnana dhatu and vijnana khanda, and there's also a word called vijnana anidasanang. And vijnana anidasanang is unmanifest consciousness. There's also some other descriptions of it, and that's not mentioned much in the text. So what you see, vijnana, as usually it's translated as consciousness, as being unsatisfactory, and that would be eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. But it's also the dhatu, the element of consciousness. So what do we call that which is present and knows and is conscious? We give it a word, but that definitely is there. It's definitely something that allows one to know the way things are. And definitely, I think, for me, there are objects which are coming and going in that experience of presence. And so the desire mind is, again, as I was reading this morning, the desire mind is the mind which is seeking fulfillment in objects through sense gratification, through all manner of things. And so that's most of our happiness seems to come from that kind of fulfillment in ideas and in relationships and having a decent April 1st, springtime, and so on. But the Buddha it is reported from enlightened beings that there is a possibility of a peace which is not conditioned. It's the unconditioned. So the language in Theravada is there is the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unborn, Nibbana, the island, the refuge, peace. And these are kind of non-words. They're interesting, they're like unconditioned. You cannot really grasp the unconditioned. It just kind of throws your mind into, what's that? Or unborn. Not eternal, unborn, undying. And the key is awareness. Awareness is the key. So what you find is the practice of liberation in Buddhism is described in terms of relinquishment, letting go, non-attachment, non-grasping. And that's the kind of language you find a lot. And so, let's say one's trying to meditate and one is kind of caught up with dullness, say. And just kind of, you see, like, how can I let go of dullness and be in this situation with clarity? Well, somehow, that's where the practice would be, right? How can I let go of dullness? So then I would do things, maybe quite deliberately. I might just go outside, get some fresh air, have another coffee, do a headstand, do pranayama, whatever, come back, and notice, oh, okay, this is the way it is now. And then it would come, ah, there it is. Okay, I begin to notice, so dullness is an object, and not get lost in it, and then, awareness knows dullness is an object. And that's non-grasping. And then maybe I lose it again, right? Kind of just go. Gosh, there it goes again. And then I berate myself. Oh, well, you came here to meditate. You didn't come here to sleep, Garadama. What are you doing? And then that's another kind of grasping, a kind of a sense of hopelessness, right? And then the mind, oh, this is a sense of being pathetic. This, really, you know, I'm hopeless. Just say that, like, I am hopeless. Sense ceases. Believe it, grasp it. I'm hopeless, I'm hopeless, I'm hopeless, I'm hopeless, I'm hopeless. Mm-hmm. You walk around, I'm hopeless. You know, posture's hopeless. So this is grasping. This is grasping of thought, ideas, the whole nine yards. Huh? Non-grasping, then you begin to sense it's consciousness. Right? It's consciousness. There's awareness, there's awakeness, there's presence, something, right? And try to be that knowing. And so there's a kind of tug from habit, from biology, all kinds of things. And now I begin to just witness and know. This is push and pull of consciousness. and to trust in that. Now, it's a very subtle kind of practice. And then, like you notice, what I suggested, say, in that body meditation, what I was trying to do is reverse the usual kind of way we look at it. Usually we look at it and look at the object, right? Hold your mind on the object, which is okay. I was suggesting, first of all, get some balance in all kinds of language, so watchful, available. Get a sense of that presence. And then pick up an object and practice presence. So the object isn't so important anymore. You know, kind of don't get lost in the object. Because we're not trying to... The reason the teaching emphasizes the impermanence of objects is so we don't grasp them. So if our meditation is just grasping an object, we can certainly deaden the mind. You know, we can get it tranquil in a kind of, like you say, a horse in a box. But then what happens when we take our attention away from it? You know, then it's just a kind of construction which is back to the same old, same old. Whereas awareness of an object, and the emphasis is more on the awareness rather than the technique, yeah? You begin to intuit that which is unconditioned. And awareness isn't really a condition in that sense. Is that like knowing isn't hot or cold or big or small or milk? You know, that's the way we talk, don't we? So vijnana is used in those two ways. In the Mahasi method, consciousness penetrates the object of attention. Is this the same consciousness which knows the knowing in the method of pure presence? One seems focused on the object, the other on presence. I'm not sure. I never followed the Mahasi Sayadaw tradition, so can't quite, again, there's only so much I know. I can't really comment on it, but this is what works for me. And then if you have other intuitions, it's not so much a right or wrong, it's the pragmatism of Buddhism that I like. So that, you know, like you really what does work and what does make sense to you, and where does your faith lie? Again, I think one of the things I found is that, like, most of us, you know, some old-time meditators here. We've been at it for a long, long time. And haven't you all seen that you kind of, you try really hard, you do stuff, meditation stuff, and then you get results. But then why don't you stick with those things? It got this really, really neat result. But yeah, I don't do that anymore. Isn't it because it was so constructed? And I put so much effort into that, and I just had to construct this huge thing, and it might have been blissful and peaceful and lovely and wow, but I don't want to have to do that all the time. And isn't there some kind of an intuition that comes, it can't be that. At least that's my sense of it. I remember doing a retreat where I did a lot of kind of constructing of really, really refined states. And it was very blissful. We got back to the monastery, so what? You know, still upset with the other monks. You know, kind of still overslept. Ate too much ice cream. You know, same old Erdemo. So that... Yeah, what is it? What is it really? What is this about? Is it just kind of creating something, or is it something that's uncreated? That's why that language I find so appealing. Uncreated. What's uncreated? Well, consciousness isn't something you create. Right? You just sit here and you listen. I'm not creating anything. Things are coming and going. I might create, you know, thoughts might be created. What's he talking about? Or something like that. It's just that, uncreated. Does it begin or end? Well, I can hear sound, I can hear my stomach gurgling, thought comes and goes, but is that consciousness, is that kind of born and dying? And that's the kind of way to reflect on this. Not just kind of compose, is this Buddha nature, right? And one character says, it is. Another says, no. So what? You know, who's right, who's wrong? It's not a question of right or wrong, not a question of opinion or position. Notice I like attachment. One of the really insidious forms of ignorance that the Buddha talked about is attachment to views and opinions. Certainly, you see that in monasteries and kind of places I hang out, where you get a kind of in-group conceit. You know, we've got the best view, the best vehicle, the best monastery. Kind of us and them garrison mentality. But you just see it. Oh, come on! And it's just a viewpoint, and people will do that. Like they'll read a book, and they'll make an opinion about it. He's not enlightened. Have you ever met him? No, but look, it says there. You midget. I mean, this is just a rant on monasticism. I kind of, these guys get up my nose. So, like a viewpoint, like, even the viewpoint, I am not enlightened, ends. I am delightful. It ends, right? I am not delightful. I am hopeless. I am 66 years old. I am a man. I am a bhikkhu. Ooh, I am Viradhammo. Positions, you know, just thoughts, just ideas. Not, actually, Samira gives a good talk about that. He says, he has the perception, I am a man. I'm not a man? I can't forget. It was very funny the way he did it. So it's just the conventional reality is there and so on, but just to know this is an opinion. Not that you don't have to have opinions, but attach them to opinions. I think we've all seen that, like especially in religion. Gosh, it can be like even like Buddhist religion. People get so cruel about views and opinions and so on. But that's just an opinion. I really enjoy the way His Holiness functions in ecumenical meetings. He's just so skillful. He's just so skillful. Sometimes you've probably heard me talk about that gathering he had in Cockforth Abbey with the Jesuits, I think. Or no, they were the John Main Society. Anyway, they asked him to lead a kind of conference on I think saying some of the gospels. And anyway, he was given several quotes, and they asked him to comment on them. And he was so very skillful. He would give his interpretation of it, and he would state his Buddhist position, and he would say, you guys are different here. But it was not a put-down. It wasn't a put-down. So, we are different. He wasn't trying to kind of whitewash it, making we're all one. He said, no, there are definitely doctrinal differences here. They're different. They asked him, if Jesus was here, what question would you ask him? Right away he said, what's the nature of the Father? Because that would be it, right? What's the nature of the Father? They asked him, and they described the resurrection of Christ. And he said, yeah, our monks can do that. And they, oh, yeah, okay. I thought our guy was unique. What do you do with that one? But it was never like, our guys can do that and yours can't. It wasn't that kind of, it was just natural, very natural. And at the end of it, he said, you chaps have it much harder. You can only do it in one life. We've got many lives to do this. So it was lovely to see, like in terms of like views and opinions, that he had his, he had his doctrine, and he was very erudite, and a couple of PhDs on that, and yet he could contribute to a dialogue and keep it all very harmonious. It was so skillful. So like a viewpoint is a viewpoint, and an attachment to it creates a sense of self and conceit and division and so on, which doesn't mean you can't have a viewpoint. One does have viewpoints. There's nothing wrong with them. But it's always this grasping, it's attachment that prevents us from understanding this more deep and profound peace. I like that. That's a nice. Could you please ask Ajahn about the attribution, is that it, of the long piece? It's from Jean Klein, who died in 1991, I think. Forget which book it's from. He's an Advaita teacher that's been very influential in my life. Jean Klein. He was from Alsace-Lorraine, I think. Interesting man. He was a doctor, musicologist. And at about the age of 30, he went out to India. And he met a Sanskrit teacher in Bangalore. But he's very accomplished, very accomplished yogi and very refined. You'd see in our Buddhist sense that his consciousness was very ripe, very refined. And so his descriptions of non-grasping and so on, I find very edifying, because I guess it's the refinement that I really kind of, how do you say it, raises my game. So I find him very, 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 like that piece, I've been reading that again and again and again. It's just so, for me, so insightful. All his books are the same. They're very good. Can you speak a little more on perception in order to see reality? Sanya. Sanya is so the word, Pali word is sanya, based on memory. So, what do we say? So there's you think of someone who has Alzheimer's and who cannot, who has the sad, doesn't understand what a cup is, doesn't understand who his daughter is. That's a person whose perception has been damaged through some kind of dementia. So perception is a necessary part of living this life. So the way we construct the world is through perceptions, natural. So this is a cup, or this is the car, or this is a spoon, or this is where the rice is kept, and so on and so forth. And then we have other kinds of perceptions, which are sort of more complex. So the plumber is a creep because he did my plumbing all wrong. That's a perception, right? It's got more narrative in it. I hate the plumber. That's something built up upon that narrative. So when I see the plumber, it's no longer just a human being, it's now a whole history of things. This guy ripped me off, I lost $2,000, the water came through my ceiling collapsed. So when I see the plumber, I no longer just see a person, I see that whole history, right? And I want to strangle him or something like that. So then perception is you could say, loaded with all kinds of information. Yeah? So we need perception. I need to make sure I don't get, hire that plumber again. So in that sense. So where perception is where we would say perception is misleading is when we perceive the impermanent to be permanent. When we perceive that which is unsatisfactory to be satisfactory, and when we perceive that which is not really ours to be ours, we perceive that which is not self to be self. And that's the way we define ignorance in Buddhism. So when I perceive that which is impermanent as permanent, then that's ignorance. And so let's say you perceive someone, you know, to be a really nice person, the plumber. You perceive someone to be a nice person. You think they're really trustworthy, right? And that perception seems real. You know, I'm a good judge of character. And then the person does something else, and of course, your perception changes. Perception changes to something else through evidence and so on. You feel confident about something. You know, I feel really confident. So say in meditation, you really feel that this is going well. My practice is really, you know, finally broken through. I have a friend. She's had so many breakthroughs. I've never had that many breakthroughs. But then she's always falling apart on me. So she has these breakthroughs. I finally sussed it, Bhante. I say, yeah, really? This is the 100th time. You've really sussed it, huh? Okay, you sure it's permanent now? Yeah, I'm really on top of it now. Comes back a week later. I don't really understand any, Bhante. I think my practice is falling apart. So she has a sense that she's accomplished something, got some kind of insight, which is just a kind of inspiration. She just got inspired by something, some idea. Probably it's just some idea, right? And then the mind gets high with that, so that the perception there, and she doesn't say, well, getting high is just, it's impermanent, it's not permanent. So she doesn't bring in the perception of anicca. She enjoys the high. She gets high, ooh, it's great. And then, of course, it was just a bunch of ideas, just a nice emotional hit, and then it crumbles, and the mind becomes doubtful, and oh no, I've lost it again, I need another breakthrough. It's like falling in love. So the perception of, you know, that which is impermanent, you perceive it as permanent. And you usually notice that when you get disappointed. So something maybe you expected someone to be some way, the retreat to be some way, you know, you had that perception that it's going to be great here, it's going to be fun and so on, that's not fun. This happens in monasteries, people come to the monastery, I just heard that people think I teach all the time in the monastery, like I'm some kind of Dharma jukebox. You know, you just come, put the coin in, sort of, give you a break. Just pop the coin in and Virdhamma will teach. And then they find I'm a human being and I like to do woodwork and I like not to be around. And they saw there was no teaching today. So they have perception, you know, the monastery is a certain way. And people have this perception, monastery is like a retreat. You know, just kind of on you know, pay-per-view, on demand, Dharma talks. And then they find, well, there's just a bunch of blokes hanging around, you know, talking about their computers or something. You know, this is disappointing, right? And it's as if we've done it to them. Right? I don't see that, you know, your perception of the monastery and thing, whatever you thought it was just a perception. You know, and then the perception changes. Oh, they're a bunch of slaggards. I'm not going there again. And then they tell other people, right? And so, you know, you build up these kind of constructs of what the world is. And then you come, oh yeah, but what the world is this way now, right? Now, the more you do that, it's just this way. Then you see what kind of perceptions are there, and they're not. You know, they can be accurate, they can be inaccurate, but then you also see that perception is not reliable very often. It's maine. Ajahn Chah would use that, the word maine, it's uncertain. That was his kind of, he always honed in on that. So rather than talk like impermanent, he would tend to use unreliable. And you know that, I've often told that story I had where there was this man who was going to come and be our gardener at Chithurst. And I asked Lompa Cha, he had met him, and I thought I knew this man inside out. You know, I had him sussed. My perceptions were accurate. And I just asked Lompa Cha, what do you think? What do you think of this man? He said, my nah, it's uncertain. And I said, wow, I never expected that answer. I expect that he's got him sussed out. He's the master. He can see everyone's mind and all that. It's uncertain. It would take a position on it. And I think it was teaching me, don't take a position on it. And yet you need perceptions. You know, if it's a bad plumber, you need to say, no, I'm not going to hire you again. You need perceptions. So the kind of the capacity to know, even though there's a perception, this is the way it is now, is actually a very empathetic thing too. You know, personally, like with people, you're cautious with people who you've had problems with, but just the capacity to not define someone and just be, this is the way it is now. This person is just this way now. And then see, what am I adding to that? What am I creating around that? I had one once in Wellington. I went to a Krishnamurti meeting. And you know, Krishnamurti was kind of anti this stuff, anti-religion and so on. And not really, because we would visit Brockwood Park and he'd be very kind to us, but there was a kind of sense of that. So anyway, I was at this Krishnamurti meeting and this woman was in a chair beside me. She looked at me, and you could see she was, it's like she was looking at an insect. You know, it's like, you poor thing, you're religious. I'm going to strangle her. And you see, her perception was just so conditioned by, you know, the kind of Krishnamurti, you know, religion is all bunk and so on, that she had already defined me. There was no way that I was going to persuade her, you know, that I was an intelligent and serious practitioner. There's just that look, you know, that kind of insect look people give you. So that was her relationship to me, her perception. She never really met me. I know that was a great loss. We do that to people, don't we? You know, we fix them through, you know, you get some experience you have, and the person's just maybe been off, had the flu, something, and they were gruff with you, and then that person becomes the gruff one, right? And then maybe you they calm, and now they're in a different mood, but then you react to the gruff one, the history. And then they are gruff to you, and you know, they're very complex. So to actually say, well, this just this way now. And then begin to see perception as being uncertain. So the uncertainty of perceptions. And then to bring up, you know, to bring up like the perception of change. To do that, you have to be quite aware, don't you? Like if you have a very difficult mood or something coming up, like some sickness or whatever, like just the perception, this is changing. Notice the changing nature of this. That's quite skillful development of perception. The perception that this is self, so like the body is mine, very strong perception. Well, whose body is it? Right? It's not your body. But just the very perception of pain comes up into the body. Pain can be known as just something which is changing, or you can grasp it and worry. I think we've all seen that. So to actually in meditation to notice discomfort. I was saying in the lying meditation, I think that's a very interesting one. Where you lie down, and discomfort comes in your hip or something, say. Your hip starts to hurt. And you know darn well it's not life-threatening, right? So you know it's okay not to move. And then you watch it, and you can see how the mind wants to move to a sense of self and time, and I need to move. And no, you just witness that, and you perceive it as change. This is changing, and your mind settles into emptiness, not self. It's empty of self. It's just vibration or whatever. I find that kind of an interesting experiment. So attachment to body, my body, and how, like, especially if you get a really difficult diagnosis, very hard to worry and be fearful. And yet, if you can develop that, this body feels this way. So the body meditation that we did today, and I suggest that just see this body is in awareness. Body is in awareness. And you see the body, you kind of relate to it as a vibratory experience. And then you do that thing with the body sound. It's very interesting, I find. But awareness is neither the body nor the sound. So you're beginning to see what non-grasping is. Perceptions of self in terms of history, who I was and what I did. So perhaps maybe I had a really unfortunate set of circumstances the last 10 years, and I really kind of blew it in some way, and it was quite, I did some unskillful things, maybe something like that, and then I start to get back on the track and get aware, and then memories start to come up. Oh God, I did that to her, or I did that to him, and oh, I shouldn't have done that. And so that creates a very strong sense of self. And then one, like socially, one can do lots of mea culpas and apologize, so that's good and so on. But just the feeling of like a failure, say. And let's say it really was a failure. It wasn't just self-disparagement. I mean, you really blew it, say. Now that's a strong memory. Very, very strong, comes into the mind. Well, what's the tendency is then to attach to that. Oh, why did I do that? I shouldn't have done that. And oh, gosh. And that's grasping. So to bear with it like a memory of failure and just say, this is a memory of failure. It feels this way. And not grasp the attachment to the perception of self. Now, that's hard to do. Why is it hard to do? Because it's so unpleasant. It's so unpleasant. You think back to when you last blew it. you said something, I'm not going to say it, and then you say it, right? And you just blast them, and you made a determination not to do that, and you did it, and you walk away, and then you're like, how? And they actually tell you why, and you realize that you made a total error again. Right? You ever had one of those? And you walk away, and then you sit, and you just feel the rubbish of that experience. And now to actually witness that is so unpleasant. So what do? You eat industrial quantities of ice cream. But then, having done that, I can't do that, you can't. You're back, you still have it, you still have the memory. So the memory comes up, and then you say, oh, what does this really feel like? What does it really feel like? And that's where desire comes in. And this experience of failure or whatever is a very unpleasant experience, and desire does not want to witness that. So then you hate yourself. Because hating yourself is a way of actually not feeling. Because it just takes you to thought. So you get, you do a kind of serious self-flagellation. And that actually feels better. Than to actually, the visceral feeling and memory of having hurt someone who didn't deserve it, say. It's an awful feeling. But then you realize, well, no, that's the kamma. That's the karmic result of having spoken in that way. And then you face your kamma. I don't know, I'm going to take it, it's fine. And this is what it feels like. And that's non-grasping. That's non-grasping. And that's seeing, and where non-grasping is this not self. Don't take this personally. And yet it is in your stream of consciousness and you are responsible for it. So then you bear witness to it. And it's very unpleasant. You don't do the ice cream. You don't do the self-disparagement. And you don't do the perception of self around it. It feels this way. And you have to keep coming back to that. Your mind goes to, oh, I'm sure I shouldn't have been that. I shouldn't have. No, no, it feels this way. It feels this way. It feels this way. It's changing. This is changing. And slowly that memory then begins to be known as an object. And as it begins to be known as an object, its power no longer deludes you. And its power begins to wane, begins to go away. And what it also does, it creates alarm bells in your consciousness that next time that comes, you're not going to go there. And the problem is you'll have more mindfulness because it was so painful. It was so painful. I mean, this is an extreme example. Extreme example. But you see how it works. So the perception of self would keep you embedded in that memory. Keep you embedded in that memory in an unskillful way. The other perception would be, well, they deserved it anyway. Some kind of arrogance, right? It's dismissal. Oh, well, watch your mind. Buddhists shouldn't attach. So that would just be a cruelty, which would lead to more and more arrogance and loneliness and so on. So the perception of self, around the body, around memory, around emotions, how emotions operate, to see emotion as emotion. The perception of satisfactoriness in that which is unsatisfactory, and this really refers to oftentimes to Nibbana, to the unconditioned. So the conditioned realm of what we're looking at, the khandhas, emotions, perceptions, the body, mental formations, various forms of sense consciousness and so on, these are all unsatisfactory in terms of the unconditioned. So, again, that kind of paradox that sense happiness is unsatisfactory. Now, this is different than a kind of that it's wrong to have happiness, a kind of what would like a that it's sinful to have happiness or something. It's not that. It's just that happiness is relative. It's relative. You know, it's not absolute. And so you have a kind of sobriety around happiness. Oh, in your and more. What I think what one has around happiness is gratitude. Oh, great! This is really nice. Rather than the perception that this is it. Any condition, anything that arises and ceases and is dependent on other factors is not it. That's what unsatisfactoriness is talking about. So that actually the more you do this, the more happy you are. This is the irony. The more one lets go of attachment to sense experience and all of that, the more one notices the color of the snow or the sound of the bird or whatever, because the mind is more and more free. That's the kind of irony of it. So what is satisfactory? So as you see, so let's say you say in a meditation experience you have like Ajahn Chah's, if your meditation makes you peaceful, then accept it. If your meditation makes you unpeaceful, accept it. Right? So we tend to kind of judge our meditations, right? So we have had a really good meditation. Wow, yes, it's really rolling, right? Unsatisfactory. Because you know darn well that then you'll have an ungood meditation. But if you're beginning to practice awareness of change, then the very perception, this is a great meditation, is simply a perception, and it's unsatisfactory. Not that it's bad, and not that it isn't good, but it's just, that's not it. Then you don't grasp it, and you're more grateful for it. But if you grasp it, then what happens? You grasp that perception, this is really good. You want to repeat the goodness. So next meditation, you think, now I've got it, it's permanent, it's mine, and it's good. And you bring that to your next sitting's a disaster. Because then you're trying to manufacture that which you had. And that doesn't work. And it doesn't mean that one doesn't have experience and you don't become adept. But how do you become adept? It's more through letting go. So maybe you had like the really good meditation, you sit down and you come to that idea of beginner's mind. Okay, I just begin again. And this is very important actually, just to begin again. I just don't know anything. I'm an earthworm. That's hard to do if you've just had a really good experience. You know, and desire gets in there and memory. So that reading, that no element from the past. That's a kind of interesting way to practice. No element from the past, just this way. So you sit down, and you feel maybe restless. Now, if you've had a good meditation and you've seen it as permanent, mine, and satisfactory, then what do you do with the restlessness? Rather than say restlessness feels this way, then you try to get rid of the restlessness in order to achieve or manufacture this thing you had last sitting. And we've all been through this one many times. And this doesn't work because it's based on desire to get something. And freedom is knowing the way things are. Because oftentimes, you'll sit through something which is quite difficult, some restlessness or dullness, and you just really bear witness to it very skillfully. And then you'll find, all of a sudden, you're walking around, your mind's very peaceful, just naturally. And why is that? Why is that? Why? Because you were willing to just be the witness to something which was difficult. You didn't seek another object. You didn't distract. And then the minds were peaceful. So those three are the perceptions of anicca, dukkha, anatta. So when you see, and this is the way we talk about ignorance. And when you see in the impermanent, when you see permanence, when in that which is not yours really, when you see a self, a permanent self, and that which is unsatisfactory, you seek satisfaction. So where can you find satisfaction? Not in a condition. No condition can do that. So what are you left with? You're left with awareness of change. Trust in that. Okay, I think I'll leave it there.